This podcast is brought to you by Upcase. Want to become the sort of developer top rail shops like Thoughtbot fight over? Join Upcase today to get the pro training, insider knowledge, access to Thoughtbot developers, and a community of like-minded learners you need. Hone core skills like Vim, Tmux, Git, and Rails by visiting upcase.com/halfoff to get 50% off your first month of Upcase. Let's get that junior out of your title and start leveling up today with Upcase.
I will warn you, I have a lingering cough from a cold from like a week and a half ago. So okay. I'm mostly fine.
I don't think the germs come through the Skype, so it'll be okay.
Okay. Yeah, good point.
Hello, Lila.
Hey, Derek.
How's it going?
It's going well. It's going pretty well. Had kind of a crazy January. I moved to a new apartment, so been a little distracted lately, but all is well otherwise. How are you?
Good. I'm doing good. I wrapped up a Rails project a little bit ago and was kind of like had a couple days unbooked, and I was like, okay, you know, I was doing some like Upcase work, and then Matt Jankowski was like, we have a project that needs either, either a Rails developer, an Ember developer, or an Elixir developer. And I was like, I'll do the Elixir development. And he was like, okay, well, let me see. And like, he came back and he was like, okay, like 2 hours later, he was like, all right, you're an Elixir developer.
Oh, it's
like,
awesome.
Okay, great. And I'd used it before, not like on a client project. Like I just kind of like gone through some of the books on it and stuff like that. Been like keeping apprised of it. Mm-hmm. But I think my experience with it so far, I thought we'd talk about that today because it's been top of mind for me.
Yeah, but, definitely.
My experience so far has been pretty fantastic.
Like, yeah. So tell me what initially led you to want to check it out in your investment time or spare time.
It has been used internally here by Blake and Paul in our Boston office, and they have built this thing called Constable on it.
Oh, you're right. I totally forgot that Constable is Elixir.
Right.
That's
so
awesome.
It's Elixir on the back end, and it is React on the front end, and it uses WebSockets and all that stuff. And it's mostly, like we joked around, Chad joked around and said that it should be called Buzzword, which I thought was actually a really fantastic name for the project.
Yeah.
Maybe they should rename it if they're listening, but especially since it's like, it's centered around messaging around tags too, so like the tags can be thought of as buzzwords. Works
right,
so well.
Right. Yeah.
But I remember when they picked it up, they were like both so excited about it, and I was like, oh, okay, it's just another thing. And like the buzzword, like I don't know, just like it did feel like a buzzword kind of thing, like chasing some buzzword.
Yeah.
And they kept talking about how great it was, and so I just kind of looked into it, and I was like, oh, this is actually really interesting. It's, you know, Elixir was created by Jose Valim, who, you know, is very familiar with Rails and Ruby among other things, and Phoenix is the web framework for it, and that's written primarily by Chris McCord, or he's the creator of it anyway. And looking at both of those things from the outside as somebody who's just kind of like looking through things, it was like it felt familiar, but it also felt like they were getting a few things right that Rails may have stepped in.
right.
And that was kind of borne out by like when I immediately got on the project, I did what I usually do for a Rails project, which is like I opened the routes because I was like, what does this thing do? The routes can generally tell me if the routes are written well.
Yep.
It'll also give me a hint as to whether or not the application is written well. And like the routes were written well, and they were also like just a touch more explicit than a Rails route would be. Like,
how so?
Well, ignoring at the top, there's like this thing called pipelines. We'll ignore that for now. But like you say resources posts or whatever, you don't say like resources and then a symbol post. You say resources and then you give it like the path that it's going to match on. So / posts, and then you give it a controller. You don't like, there's no magic. There's no magic behind what controller it maps to. There's no like pluralization. Like if you said resources in Rails, if you say resources symbol post, right, it's going to map to the posts controller pluralized, and that trips up a lot of people, myself included. Like I mess that up on occasion too, and here you don't have that problem. Like there's a convention in Phoenix that your controllers are singular, not plural.
Oh, interesting.
But
that,
it doesn't
from
really
Rails.
Right, but it doesn't really matter
able. Yeah,
because you're going to explicitly tell it what controller to map to anyway.
Cool. So it's more explicit, and because it's more explicit, it's also a little more flexible.
Right. And it's just like I can then just use C tags to jump right to the controller from the routes, right? Because there's a constant right there that it can look up.
Nice.
And then the routes themselves, like at the top, I mentioned this pipelines thing. You can declare your individual routes as being part of a pipeline, like a member of a pipeline, and you can set pipelines up to do things like authentication. Like any route that goes through this pipeline requires authentication. So stuff that might get hidden away in inherited controller-based classes,
actions,
like before filters and things like that, things that are like shared amongst everything can kind of just be put there.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it's a little more like, oh, this is what happens on requests to, like, you want to know what happens to on requests to your admin pages, right? You can tell that it's going to authenticate the person as an admin, and then here are all the controllers underneath that, and you can tell all that directly from the router without having to be like, oh, let me go look at one of these admin controllers. Okay, it inherits from, you know, admin base. Let me go look at admin base. Admin base does this, right? So everything's just a little bit a step closer from the routes immediately, and like that was my first introduction to it, and I was like, okay, this I like better, so that's cool.
That is cool.
So that was like my introduction to it. It was just the routes. I remember I jumped into like our Elixir chat room and I was like, the router, this is great. Like, it's very similar, but the ways in which it's different are better. And I have yet, at least in the router, to find a way in which it's different that is not better. So that's interesting, I think.
So one thing I'm curious about is, I understand that in what I've read about Elixir, it's supposed to be very good at concurrency. And my guess is that you would reach for something like Elixir and Phoenix when you want to write like a chat app or something along those lines. But it also sounds just very usable and enjoyable to use. So in your current client project, do you know what the factors were that led to them deciding to go with Elixir and Phoenix?
They were on a project that was their current like deployed version of this site is written in Node.
Okay.
And I guess to them, I haven't looked at the code, but from what they say, it's hopeless and needs to be rewritten for whatever reason. I haven't dug into that. And the people they were working with previously really wanted to work in Elixir, and a couple of the people there had experience with Elixir. So the folks at the client are all, I think it's fair to say they're more experienced with JavaScript. So they have that background, and they're doing an Ember front end, and then there's people that are trying to learn Elixir as well. And then Paul and I are working on it from Thoughtbot on the Elixir stuff.
Okay, cool.
So I don't know if what informed that decision was like a concern about a performance, or like they knew they needed to rewrite it and they just decided like, well, let's use Elixir or what the case may be. But, you know, I'm certainly enjoying it.
Yeah. That's cool.
They're not like, it is just an API. So it's not making use of any of Phoenix's channel support.
Okay, yeah. I was going to ask if you're using...
No.
Channels or PubSub.
Mostly just using it the way I would use Rails, right?
Uh-huh.
And it feels pretty good. It feels like a better Rails to me.
Oh, wow.
You know, to to get right to the conclusion.
Yeah.
So far, you know, and it's not, it isn't just a matter of like it being new and me being like, oh, I'm in love with this new thing. Because I've tried other new things that just don't like kind of capture my like, oh, I just want to do everything in this now. But this has kind of like captured my, I just want to do everything in this now. And to be fair, like I'm building an API, so I haven't used much of the like view layer type stuff. I've played around with their version of the asset pipeline, which actually is not an Elixir thing. They use Brunch, which is like a NPM library for doing asset pipeline type things. So I don't know how like equivalently powerful that is, but it seems like a wise decision at this point. Like when the Rails asset pipeline was around, there weren't really JavaScript native style things that did what the pipeline does, right? And now that tooling has matured. So rather than re-implementing that in Phoenix and Elixir, they farm off to Brunch in this case, which seemed like a good idea.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So you're building a JSON API in Elixir.
Yep.
And the things I can think of that you would need in that situation is obviously you need an ORM and you need something to serialize the data. So how does serialization work, or are there serialization libraries that you use with Phoenix?
Yeah, it's this project. I mean, I'm not familiar with all the libraries, but this project is using a library called JA Serializer, so JSON API _ Serializer. Mm-hmm. We can link to that in the show notes. But it is reminiscent of like active model serializers in a lot of ways. It works. Like there were some. I think my first Elixir patch to an open source project was to that, to like clarify some of the deprecation messages and make them consistent and make them like noticeable.
Mm-hmm.
and we fixed some of that stuff. There were like the thing I worked on, the first pull request I worked on this app was Ian, who was working on the Ember side, had noticed that like a number of the endpoints were super slow.
Oh yeah.
And he was like, I thought Elixir was fast. Like, what's going on? And it was like, I looked at it and I was like, it's doing hundreds of queries. I was like, this is the same problem all over again. Like what? Uh-huh. Like, okay. So like that made me take a step back and I was like, oh, so I guess I'm doing this thing where I fix N plus one queries again, just in a different language. And what it turned out to be was like, we were using an older version of the serialization library because Ecto, which is the ORM, you mentioned you'd also need an ORM. Ecto is the ORM that Jose writes. And it is very explicit. Like it will not, if you try and access an association that's not yet loaded, you get an association not loaded back.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I think what was happening was this older version of the serializers was detecting that and then loading it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it was just going ahead and firing off the query. So once we upgraded, the serializers, one of the breaking changes was that we're no longer doing that for you. And then it just became a matter of like reading the error messages that get output to say like, oh, this association is not loaded. And then going into the controller and making sure we preload the needed associations.
Yep.
So that was actually really nice to know that like this, like, yes, I did have to deal with N plus one queries, but it was because the library was probably behaving in a way that like the ecosystem would not like it to behave in, right? Not because it was something that was easy to mistake.
Yeah, that's pretty cool that the new version of this library tells you when
right.
the association.
Yep. So Ecto is very, very explicit. It doesn't, like moving on to Ecto a little bit. Like
it doesn't
inspect your schema like Rails does. So there's a little duplication that you have to do. Like you would write your migration very similar to how it has migrations, just like Active Record has migrations. They're a little more close. The language of their migrations are a little more closely aligned with the language of the SQL that you would write.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like add index, it's create index, that kind of thing. So that's a little bit, it takes a little getting used to, but then it's also like, oh, I can see why they made that change or why they decided to go that way. You know, not that it's a change they made. It wasn't like they're porting over Rails, but it does feel like that in some places.
Yeah.
But so you would write your migrations and you would say like a post has a title, a post has a body, it has an author ID, it's associated to an author, that kind of thing. But then you go into your what are currently called models, but I guess in the next version of Ecto will be called schemas because they're not traditional models.
Mm-hmm.
And you define all of that again.
Okay.
So you say, here is the schema. So it doesn't reflect on the database, which is both a blessing and a curse, I think.
Right. Yeah.
It makes stuff like Sean has talked about with the attributes API a little easier because there's no like reflection layer that you have to like get in between. You know, you can just you can declare that your schema has this field and it maps to this type.
Right. They're not
right.
coupled.
There's nothing to hook into in order to declare that.
Yeah.
Which is a bunch of work Sean has done to kind of make that the case in Rails as well.
Yep.
But this kind of does that out of the box, which is nice.
Yeah.
So those two things, like you get Ecto and it helps you, it saves you from terrible queries for the most part, from what I've seen.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And you get, you know, JA serializers does a decent job of doing JSON. I guess I should say as decent a job as I've seen anybody yet do of producing something that somebody could look at and be like, yes, that conforms to JSON API, because you can't, there's no schema for it. So you can't just be like, that has been a little bit of a trouble on this project, is like not being able to just say like authoritatively, does this response conform to JSON API as part of our test suite? Because there's no JSON schema for JSON API.
Yes. I feel like this is a tangent, but...
No, let's do the tangent.
The tangent is that I feel like I was relatively recently reading the JSON API frequently asked questions. And there's a question on there that's like, can I describe JSON API in terms of JSON schema? And it says yes. But I've also heard anecdotally from at least a couple of people that that's not possible, that you can't do it. So, and this, you know, your story here is one of those anecdotes. It just doesn't work. It's not working. It's not possible.
Oh, this is a change. Interesting.
Does it say that?
Yeah, no, it doesn't say that. I'm looking it up. So on the FAQ says, yes, you can find the JSON schema definition at jsonapi.org/schema. It's as restrictive as possible, but has flexibility to be extended within your documentation.
Right. That's what I remember reading.
It used to say no.
Oh, really?
It used to say that JSON schema was not flexible enough, which really meant that JSON API was too flexible to be nailed down to any one schema. So I'll have to look into this. This is definitely a change, because I know when I talked to Gordon about JSON API on an earlier episode of the show, which we'll link to in the show notes, I think we read through it as well, and both of us saw that it said no earlier.
It's funny that we're revisiting this.
Right. It's interesting. Now, well, it's great, because now I know this has changed, and I should look into this, because like we had problems where like some of the responses have pluralized keys and some of them don't. And I was like, well, which one is actually are you supposed to be doing for JSON API? And so these types of things are like, I don't know if anybody has a like perfectly conforming JSON API. Like,
yeah,
a perfectly conforming API that returns JSON that conforms to JSON API at the spec.
Right.
It's really an unfortunately named spec.
It is. It is an unfortunately named spec. It also seems kind of aspirational. Like,
we are the JSON API.
Yeah.
You know, this is the first team I'm working with that is like trying to use it throughout, and everybody has complaints about it. So I'm no expert on it. I'm just using the serializers and then trying to be like, oh, okay, this is supposed to be plural, so we'll make this change, that kind of thing. But
yeah, that seems like the approach you have to take to maintain your sanity. Because if you try to just write everything at once to adhere to this schema, then I think it's easy to get lost down rabbit holes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I thought about doing that when I realized that, like, oh, the outermost data node here is supposed to be plural for all of these serializers. And I was like, oh, okay, I should change all that. And I was like, oh, no.
No.
It's like, I'll do it one by one when I have to. Because, like, the Ember side is already written to like, either the Ember JSON API adapter has the same issue, or they've already accounted for it and like overwritten their serializers to handle it. And then like, it's just this back and forth that you have to deal with when you have a split project like this too. It gets complicated.
Yeah. We were talking about something else before we started talking about JSON API. We were talking about Ecto.
Oh yeah. We were talking about Ecto having like it doesn't reflect on the schema. So you have to tell it a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's kind of a theme throughout. I would say it takes me more code to do equivalent things, not much more code. It can feel occasionally, and this is Phoenix/Elixir. This is really Phoenix that I'm talking about at this point, Phoenix and Ecto. It can feel a little more boilerplatey, I think.
Interesting.
At the same time, when I say like, oh, this feels like boilerplate, I look at it and I understand it's boilerplate right now because it's the same everywhere. But I also understand there are frequent cases, like cases that are going to come up frequently enough that it's worth this boilerplate, where you're going to want to change the boilerplate in some place, right? And now you have that ability to do so.
Yeah.
It also does things like force you to handle, like if you call save or something like that, the return value you get is a tuple, which says like, either it's okay and here's your record, or it failed and here's your change set that you passed me to make that failed for this.
Okay.
Which kind of forces you to handle both via pattern matching, which Elixir has as well.
Right.
So it forces you to handle both of those via pattern matching. If you don't, it'll say you have a non-exhaustive pattern.
Yeah. So I understand that Elixir is a functional language. How does that inform your experience in the code base?
You know, I haven't thought too much about it, I guess. When I think about it is like when I find myself, I know I have a list of items and I just want to call map on them. And I'm like, oh, no, wait. I have to do like enum.map and then provide the list and then, you know, provide a function to go over those lists, a little more like JavaScript-y, you would see. And that's when I start to think about it. But for the most part, what's been nice is like a lot of the code I've written in Rails apps lately has been trying to like break out of Rails as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
And then I find myself writing in a more functional style once I do that. So I might write a command object that has like take some sort of state in, and then it has one method, which is like perform this thing, which is basically a function at that point.
Yep.
So it has been pretty comfortable, actually, except for when I need to like get over my muscle memory of being able to just like dot syntax everything.
Yeah.
For message passing.
This might not be a good question, but I remember reading that in Elixir, there are lists and there are tuples. But tuples are stored in memory, which makes them fast to access but expensive to update. So do you ever find yourself like thinking, oh, I should be making sure to construct a list here instead of a tuple or anything like that.
No, this hasn't really come up.
Yeah, it just doesn't come up.
I still get confused between, like, is this a list? Is this a tuple? Is this a keyword list? Is this a, mm-hmm. is this a map? Because there's a few different types that are involved there. I still don't have it all nailed down. And Elixir 1.1, Elixir prior to 1.2 had, like, map, hash map, and a couple other things. Elixir 1.2 made maps. I think I'm getting this right. Elixir 1.2 made maps more performant for large collections, so they're kind of soft deprecating some of those other things that were built for larger collections.
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of trying to simplify things. So I have to figure out what I really need to learn and then try to learn
if you have maps, then that's your go-to. You don't go to tuples. If you have maps, then use
right.
those.
Some things have tuples. Some things have maps. I don't know. Or as I saw today, like a list of tuples is another thing you'll see sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have enough experience to really.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it doesn't really matter.
It doesn't matter for what I'm doing right now.
Yeah. And in terms of performance, it would probably take a long time to get to the point where it did matter.
Right. Everything is super fast right now. Mm-hmm. When we got onto this project, there were probably somewhere around 400 tests or something like that. And it was taking 25 seconds,
mm-hmm.
which I was a little disappointed with, because I was like, I thought this was really fast, right? Like, what's going on?
Yeah.
And we fixed the N+1 bug that I talked about earlier. We fixed a couple other things, like we replaced some fixtures. They had this fixture library in use when we started, which was like Rails fixtures. When you load them, you typically load them once and then you run your entire test suite.
Mm-hmm.
These are fixtures that get loaded every time you need them in the test. So they're kind of like factories.
Mm-hmm.
But they load a bunch of data that you may or may not use. So we've been switching, you know, as we update tests to Ex Machina, which is a library that Josh Steiner and Paul Smith at Thoughtbot wrote, which is basically a port of Factory Girl to Elixir.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know much about it except that it works very similarly. Like, it doesn't have some of the things that Factory Girl has. I know I've talked to Josh Clayton, who maintains Factory Girl, and he said like, oh, it's great that they got a chance to, like, not make the same mistakes that we made with Factory Girl. So he seems pretty jealous of it. So that's cool, I guess.
Nice.
But once we did that, today I think the tests, we now are up to, like, 450 tests. So we have more tests, better coverage, and we're down to, like, the tests take, like, 6 seconds to run or something like that.
Oh, that's a huge difference. That's massive.
And, like, to have a 450 test suite that takes 6 seconds to run. I mean, that doesn't count if it has to compile before it runs, but, like, still, like, it's really, really nice for TDD. Although sometimes when it has to recompile, the TDD loop gets a little like, oh, okay. Like, compiling is not slow. I can still compile and run the whole test suite faster than I can run the test suite in most Rails apps. So
definitely. Yeah, I think on my project right now, it's like 5 minutes on CI.
Yeah. I've been like experimenting in the Ember part of the code base a little bit, because I want to help out there as well. When we make changes on the API side that are going to break Ember, like, I don't want to just be like, here, I made this change.
Go fix it,
people who work on Ember. Like, I want to be able to investigate what the impact of the change is going to be, and then maybe even potentially just make the change myself, even though I don't have Ember experience at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been kind of working with Ian a little bit to pick that up. And the test there, it's interesting because, like, I feel like years ago, people used to tell you they really liked JavaScript because they could just, like, write it in their browser, and it was, like, really lightweight to edit. And, like, you know, when you make an edit, you could refresh. There's no compile step or anything like that. But writing JavaScript in 2016 and trying to write, like, modern JavaScript with ES6 means you have to, like, compile it down to ES5.
Right.
You're probably linting everything, stuff like that. That all takes time. So it takes, like, 20 seconds to build the JavaScript project. And I don't know. I mean, this might be absurd. I don't know. Like, I don't have experience with this, but it's just to build it without running the tests.
Mm-hmm.
And then testing it takes several minutes, like 8 or 9 minutes to run the test suite, because they have a lot of acceptance tests that do actually, like, click around the site.
Mm-hmm.
They're not hitting the API or anything like that, but, you know, they're doing some stuff. So it's an interesting contrast to see, like, oh, they have slow tests too. And I don't know if that's just this Ember project or if, you know, in talking to Ian, he said that acceptance level tests in Ember are just slow. Like, that's just the thing. And to be fair, we don't have, in the API side, we don't have any tests that would be equivalent to, like, capybara tests. We do have tests that go through the whole stack and, like, submit params. They go through the router. They get to the controller. The controller prepares the serialized response and then returns the serialized response. but there's no clicking, right? There's no like click this element, load this page. And I don't know how those would perform, but I know for certain that like just in my experimentation that like when you do get to having to write HTML views, the HTML views are significantly faster in Elixir. So I'd expect it to be faster. I just don't know. If you had a full like Rails app and then you ported it to you ported every feature to Elixir and it wasn't using an API or anything like that, I don't know like whether or not the speed up. I know the app would be faster. I don't know if your tests would see a similar thing. I suspect they would, but who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. I have not worked on an Ember project. The only relevant experience I have in that area is working on standalone Angular apps, which I don't remember the tests having taken that long to run, but I also don't think that there were that many tests, and there were definitely not very many acceptance tests. They were all just unit tests.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the unit test part, they do run a lot faster. Like once it gets past those acceptance tests, it's pretty fast.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's been like my general experience has been like it's a little more explicit than Rails in places, but it's very familiar if you're a Rails developer. So it's easy. It was really easy for me to pick it up and get into it.
How is the tooling for debugging?
There is a debugger that I have not used. I want
you haven't needed to. Great.
Right. There is a debugger that I haven't used. There's been a couple times where I've wanted it and I've been like, I should look up how to use the because there is a debugger. I just haven't like you got to for some reason it's not committed as a dependency to like if you look up how to do it, a lot of places say like don't add this as a dependency and it's like, well, why not? Nobody explains to me why you wouldn't just have it there all the time. Uh-huh. So anything that I have to go and edit my like the equivalent of the gem file in Elixir, anything I have to go and do that every time I want to use it. Is just there's too much friction for me to want to actually use it.
Yeah.
So I just haven't explored that too much. You can call inspect on basically anything and get back what you need for puts debugging, the equivalent of puts debugging, I guess.
Cool.
So I've been doing a decent amount of that.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it seems it's pretty enjoyable. The testing framework we're using XUnit. There is XSpec or something similar to RSpec or whatever, which. As a first for me, I actually really enjoy the XUnit style.
Oh, yeah?
I usually really miss RSpec when I do other testing frameworks, but XUnit seems pretty nice. Like, I'm sure it has other assertions, but every assertion I use is just assert, and then I assert something equals something else, and that's it. And, like, the errors I get back aren't, like, if you were to do that in Rails or in Minitest or whatever, you would see, like, expected false got true. Mm-hmm. But it tells me, like, expected... You know, the left-hand side to be this, and the right-hand side was actually expected the left-hand side to match the right-hand side, and here's what the left-hand side was, and here's what the right-hand side was.
Yeah.
So you get a better assertion message out of that. So, which is really, when I look at it, it's a lot of what I get out of the RSpec matchers is really good error messages.
Yeah. I feel like a couple times you've mentioned how good the error messages are in a couple different tools, like in Ecto, it sounds like, in XUnit. And so do you feel like maybe you haven't felt super compelled to reach for a debugger because you're getting really good feedback from the error messages?
I don't know. It's tough to say.
Yeah, it's...
The error messages aren't like... They're not Elm-level error messages where like you get like an ASCII drawing that's telling you what's going on. Like if you see some of those that come out of Elm, it's pretty impressive. But they're useful. There's no equivalent that I've seen of like you called ID on -2, or, you know, like the weird stuff you used to get out of Ruby, which I think they've kind of fixed as well anyway. So I wouldn't say the error messages are fantastic. Mm-hmm. There's certainly a lot of libraries that aren't doing a great job of outputting like deprecations in a consistent manner and in a way that tells you like where the code that triggered the deprecation is. Like with the JA serializers library, that was big part of the change I committed was like, I see these deprecations, but it doesn't tell me where they're coming from.
Ah, I see,
So it doesn't have caller information in there, basically.
Yeah.
So I think there's some room to work. I think there's some room to go there, but you know, it hasn't been anything that's been like contrasted with when we were trying to debug some Ember problems yesterday. And it was like, here's a giant stack trace. None of it is our code. like what? Like, I don't know where to go. So it gave me a stack trace, but the stack trace was not helpful at all.
Yeah.
So
interesting. So speaking of room for improvement, what are the things that have struck you that could be better about Elixir or Phoenix?
I missed the Rails CLI, which I didn't think I would say.
Interesting.
So in Elixir, everything that you would typically do with the Rails command or the rake command, or even the bundle command, you basically pipe through mix.
Okay.
So you say like, you say mix, you know, deps.install or deps.get, I think is what it is. And that's basically install, I think. I forget exactly. But something like that. And then like, if you wanted to generate an Ecto, what they're going to call schema, but is currently a model, you would, or a migration, let's say a migration, you would say mix ecto.gen.migration and then give it a name.
Mm-hmm.
So what that does, it's interesting. I don't know how I feel about this yet, but it means that I have to know that when I'm generating a migration, I'm using Ecto. So it would be equivalent as if you, if instead of saying Rails generate migration, you said like rake
active record,
rake active record generate migration, right? So you have to know. And like when I want to start the server, I say mix phoenix server, phoenix.server.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that starts the server. If I want to get into a, then I'm like, okay, so I use everything in mix that I can get used to this. I can understand what parts are provided by who. And then you get into it and you're like, okay, I want to get into a console. So I'm like, I don't know, mix console, mix phoenix console, mix. Like, nope. The way you do that is you do IEX dash capital S mix. I don't really know what that does just yet.
Huh, interesting.
But I think it passes your mix environment to IEX, which is the REPL.
Yeah.
And so then it boots it up in that context. So you get all the dependencies that you would have inside your project.
Yeah.
And you can go a step further and say IEX-X mix phoenix.server. And that starts it up as if that starts up the server and gives you a console with the server
that's
running.
That's cool. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. But like having to know like, oh, now I need to run and not just like everything goes through Rails or rake. And in Rails 5, everything's actually going to go through Rails. So it's, I think, partly a blessing in that, like, you have to know your dependencies and what they're providing.
Mm-hmm.
And partly a curse in that, like, you have to know your dependencies and what their CLI is. but it's a small, that's a pretty small thing that I've kind of stumbled across. But I think it's something anyway. That's a little bit of a tripping point. And then the only other thing I can think of is the Elixir REPL is not as nice to me anyway as the Ruby REPL. It's built on an Erlang REPL, I think, because Elixir itself is built on Erlang. It makes use of a lot of Erlang tools. You can interact with Erlang libraries, things like that. But like, it does weird things. Like, I'm used to pressing Control D to disconnect from either a terminal or a shell or whatever. Or so it works if you're in, you know, the Postgres shell. If you're in PSQL, you can press Control D and you exit. If you're in Pry or IRB, you press Control D and you can exit. If I'm in IEX and I press Control D. Nothing
you know what?
Happens.
I noticed that. I remember that when I was like, I haven't done much with Elixir, but I did mess around with it, and I could not figure out how to exit. I could not figure out how to get out of it. I had to like look up the documentation to exit.
Right.
The
so you press Control C, and then something else comes up, and you press Control C again.
Yeah.
And then you're out. But I've also done like I'm used to in Ruby. I'm used to being in the REPL and typing half of a line and realizing it's not what I want, and then pressing Control C, mm-hmm. and it just cancels that line and gives me a fresh new line. And now I press Control C and this menu gets up and I haven't figured out how to get from that menu
back
to what I'm doing.
Yeah. that sounds pretty annoying.
That's a little interesting. Other little things, like it just hasn't been as, like, I have, you know, 5-6 years of worth of, you know, learning little Ruby REPL tricks that don't translate to IEX.
Yeah.
And the Control D thing is actually the one that's driving me driving me nuts. Like yesterday, in the Ruby REPL, you can use underscore to represent the return value of your last successful command.
Right.
So you can, like, if you run a command, you're like, oh, I actually wanted to capture that to a variable. You can just do foo equals underscore, and then you've captured it. And there's been a couple times I've wanted to do that. So finally yesterday I went digging, and there's like, you can use V for that for whatever reason. I don't know.
That's cool.
Value, I guess. I'm not sure. Uh-huh. But like that took a while to kind of figure out. So all this stuff, I think the REPL's slightly, I think people would mostly agree that the REPL is better in Pry or IRB. But other than that, like the differences I've really liked, it's more explicit in places. There's still convention over configuration in a lot of places. Like where they decided to be more explicit was wise. And honestly, like I think the biggest one was not doing the pluralization stuff for you automatically. Mm-hmm. Like that was a brilliant decision. and like it's just been kind of business as usual for the most part, which is actually really nice. It's like if you're a Rails developer and you're curious about Elixir, your skills are basically going to carry right over. You're going to be comfortable within a week.
Right. That sounds really satisfying to be able to jump on something and it not be so foreign that you can't be comfortable and familiar with it within a week or two. And But it's still like new and you're still learning things.
Right. So it's got that newness to it, which means like I go home at night and I'm still playing around with it because I'm like, this is great. I'm having I want to get better at this so that I'm better when I'm doing my stuff. And I also just want to I want to know more about this. And right now I'm really just using it like I would use Rails. I'm not using any of the channel stuff or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. This is a kind of a random question, but I remember that you can define custom types in Elixir, mm-hmm. and I was wondering basically how that's used in the real world and if you have any custom types in your application.
Yeah, so there's, I think I'm going to get this terminology right. I'm not super familiar with it, but there's this idea of type specs.
Right. That's the thing that allows you to define a custom type.
Right. And so Paul, I've seen use them in a couple places, and I've talked to him about what's this getting you? Where he's used it is in places where we have, say, like something that delivers mail or something like that. And we wrote something that delivers mail in production, but in development or test, we want to swap that out with a different thing. Mm-hmm. So in the development version or in the production version, he defines a type spec.
Oh, cool. Okay.
It says like it has to have these methods or whatever. They behave like this. They return this.
Yep.
And then the test version, when he swaps that out, will have to also implement the same things returning the same types.
Yep.
It's not anywhere near what you would get from something that has actual like built-in forced strong typing everywhere, but it can mm-hmm. get, but used, it seems like, I'm not an expert. It seems like used, I'm not an expert. I've only been doing this a few weeks. It seems like used appropriately, it can, used in the right places, it can solve some of the problems that you would want to solve with type systems. Not nearly all of them. And I don't think you get like the performance benefits you would get from a strong type system or anything like that. But I haven't looked into it too much, but that's where I've seen that we're using it. And I thought it was a really good use when Paul introduced that in a couple different places.
Yeah, that's cool. That's a really great example.
Mm-hmm. And like in comparison to the languages we talk about a lot, which would be like, we talked about Haskell a lot on the show, I think.
Yeah, Haskell has come up a lot.
Right. And then Rust, obviously, we've talked about a lot. So Rust has like strong, strict typing, right?
Yeah.
Haskell has strong, strict typing. And also Haskell is also like functionally pure. Like it's, whereas Rust is willing to be more loosey-goosey with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Functional purity is not like a tenet of Rust.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would say that's the same thing with Elixir. It doesn't seem to be like immutability is a thing in Elixir, but functional purity is not necessarily like a thing you can, it's not
yeah,
always
yeah,
the same.
No, I get what you're saying. Yeah.
Which, I don't know, I mean, seems okay to me so far. It does, like I was talking about with Joe Ferris a little bit, because he loves Haskell and he wants everybody to write Haskell.
Yes.
And I was, walking a lunch with him and I was like, I've really liked doing the Elixir work. Like, I feel like it has solved some of the pains that I typically have with Rails, or I see in Rails, like just this N+1 query. I feel like that's the first thing I do on established apps where I come in. I'm like, oh, they have a ton of N+1 queries, right? So just having an ORM that actively discourages having N+1 queries mm-hmm. is a huge win. And there's other small things like that that all I feel like add up. And I'm not willing to say like, I don't want to use Rails anymore. I only want to use Elixir. But certainly right now, I'm very much interested in that. And Joe's point was like, that's great. I just want to get the inertia moving.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I just want to get people moving. And if people like you and some other people, they're like, oh, okay, Elixir's interesting. Let me check this out. They're already moving.
Yeah.
So like, maybe now I can be like, you want to go a step further? Like, let's do this Haskell stuff or Rust right. or whatever,
Yeah. Elixir is the gateway drug.
Right. That's kind of what he's excited about, which is interesting. It's true. Like, we really do have a built up knowledge of Rails here. Like, we hired specifically for that in a lot of cases. And I think we do a little less of that now. Like, we're willing now to take on people who have experiences in other places. But you do have to have experience with Rails because of the number of Rails projects we work on.
It's mostly what we do.
It's kind of like the year of the, I think it was Joe or somebody was saying this, it's kind of the year of the polyglot at ThoughtBot.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like, I know our New York office is actually doing a lot of Python work currently.
Yeah.
We haven't taken, I thought I might end up on one of those projects. So earlier, I think I talked to you about Python earlier.
Yes.
In an earlier episode.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. We talked about that.
But I never actually got, like, that's the big difference, I feel like, is like in a similar way that I played with Elixir and Phoenix, I played with Python and Django.
Mm-hmm.
But the big difference was, here's a project to sink your teeth into.
Yeah. You also sound more excited about Elixir than you sounded about Python when we talked. Yeah.
That could be, I think it's because it's different enough that it's exciting.
Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
Python wasn't different enough.
Yeah.
And also because, like I was just saying, like having a real thing to do makes all the difference. Right.
Yeah.
Like my wife has been going back to school to become a teacher, and she has to like, part of what she's doing for one of these classes, she has to keep like a journal of young adult literature or children's literature that she's read and like what she thinks is appropriate about it and like what she thinks kids could get out of it, that kind of thing. And she's just been like writing in a spreadsheet. And I was like, can I build you an Elixir Phoenix app for this? And she was like, no. I was like, but I could do it in probably like a couple nights. It'd be done. It'd be great. And she was like, no, no, I want to use my spreadsheet. I was like,
That's amazing.
Okay.
Okay, awesome. So I guess you are available, ready and willing to build Elixir apps.
Yeah, I'm ready and willing to build Elixir apps because I want to find more things. I honestly want to find more things I don't like about it. Like I want something to come up and make me like be like, oh, because I do feel a lot of the way I felt about Rails when I first started, where I was like, this is fantastic, but I know there's something hiding out there. I know there's something people with more experience with Elixir are listening to this podcast going, just wait until you find out about X. And maybe they still like Elixir, but they know about the dark corners, right? And I don't know the dark corners yet.
You do sound very positive, which is great, but almost like I'm a little skeptical.
Naively, so.
Is your experience really this great? I'm sure it is right now, but it'll be interesting to see what you discover, especially if you work more in the Vue layer and with assets. Elixir and Phoenix and see what comes up there, because that is often an area where frameworks don't necessarily do things the way you would like them to.
And I really do like the Rails asset pipeline. For as much like pain as it originally caused when it came out, like it does a really nice job of like digesting everything so that you have like unique URLs and giving you helpers that you can then include those unique URLs in your CSS. Like, I don't know how that happens.
Yeah, it's magical.
I don't know how they're going to do that, how they replicate something like that in Brunch, but maybe they do. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I haven't had to do that just yet. I would love to do an end-to-end Elixir app with no JavaScript front end and find out. Mm-hmm. So if you've got one you want to build, you can go to thoughtbot.com and click hire us.
and we'll make it for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For a fee.
Right. You'll have to pay some money. But
but if I sold you, are you ready to jump in?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I am totally sold. and I did play around with Elixir a little bit, and I read the Phoenix docs, and I was really impressed. The documentation was great. Elixir, the syntax and the conventions are similar to Ruby, so it was very readable to me. Mm-hmm. So... yeah, maybe I'll start helping out on Constable. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what needs to be done there. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah,
it's been really enjoyable. And the other corollary I would say to Ruby is like, you know, Ruby has the like Mats is nice and so we are nice, and you know, Mats is the person who created Ruby and he's just like a nice guy, right? And like Jose created Elixir and Jose is just a great person. Like I've interacted with him already a couple of times and a couple pull requests, and he's just like a perfectly cool person to interact with. So it's like nice. It's a nice community. Not that Rails is not a nice community. It's a bigger community.
Yeah.
I would say. So like just dipping my toes into the Elixir open source community, I run into the same people a lot already, you know, which is kind of interesting. But yeah, it's just a fun thing to be doing right now, I think. So be kicking the tires on it more.
Cool. Cool. I'm excited for you. And I'm excited to do more myself.
Yeah. I hope we can find more work and get more people trying it out, because I do think either they'll like it or the inertia will encourage them to find something else they like. But because I don't know, are you talking to a lot of people who are just like, no, Rails is great, I want to stay with Rails forever?
Nope. Yep. Nope.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm not either, and that might just be like our nature, right? Like that nobody wants to just continue writing what they're writing forever.
Yeah.
I would say I was a little more protective of it like when I first started here.
Yeah.
Because I was like, no, I just got to be like an expert in this thing, and now you want me to go learn Haskell? Like, but now, you know, the shine is worn off, I guess. And I guess the shine wears off on all things probably, but.
Yeah. I think that the shine wears off when you feel like you're solving the same problems with the same tools in the same way over and over. And if you can change one of those things, you know, solve the same problems with different tools, then it's more interesting. And maybe you're even taking the same approaches, making the same design choices. But if you're changing the tooling, then it's just more interesting.
Yeah, that's probably spot on. Because like I would say I was definitely in a spot where I had solved, like a lot of my projects had been performance-oriented projects where I was seeing the same performance mistakes that people make in Rails every time.
Over and over.
Like, okay, N plus one query here. You're firing queries from the view over here. Like just the same problems again and again. Mm-hmm. And so changing both the problem, like now this is an API and it's not like the work is not performance, and the tools, like basically changed everything, and kind of just like it came along at the perfect time for me. Probably I was getting a little burned out on the work I was doing. So came along at a great time.
Good.
Anyway, that's all I get to say.
Yeah, this is really interesting. I really enjoy hearing about your experience with Elixir, and it sounds awesome. And I do have more questions, but they're the kind of questions that should be asked like in pull requests, you know.
Okay.
Those kinds of things.
We are probably going to talk about Elixir more just because I'm working on it and excited about it, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we've reached out to José Valim, and he's going to come on next month sometime and talk about Ecto, which is the ORM we discussed, and he's going to chat with Sean about Diesel, which is the ORM Sean wrote.
Awesome.
And they're going to compare notes, which I think will be really exciting to see, like, where their inspirations were the same and where they're different and how their implementations differ. And I know Sean actually just released a really important version of Diesel himself, like 0.5, which added SQLite support, which he's really excited about, and he got a lot of publicity for the Diesel library on Hacker. It was like the number one story on Hacker News for a while. So it was pretty cool. It's really interesting to see all these different things coming together.
Yeah, it's going to be a really good conversation. I'm looking forward to that.
All right. Should we wrap up?
Yes.
All right, cool. Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/52.
Rating and reviews on iTunes are greatly appreciated.
If you have feedback about this episode or any others, you can tweet us @_bikeshed, email us at hosts@bikeshed.fm, or leave a comment on the website.
Thanks for listening to The Bike Shed. See you next time.